Psst. Hey, you. Want access to exclusive Secret Ops intel? Check out the link in the description.
Something you're not excited about and you're not, is your strength, a waste of your resources and time to like try to fix that, as opposed to you can just go and find someone who is good at that while you focus on what you can do better.
Welcome to Secret Ops, the podcast uncovering the world of operations one episode at a time. I'm your host, Ariana Caffone, and today's guest is Soumyam Mitra, founder and CEO of Rudderstack, which is a company that helps data leaders to collect, unify, and activate their customer data. Now, Soumya has seen the evolution of the world of technology and data throughout his career, and even before that when he was getting his PhD. So we were really able to dive into the evolution of artificial intelligence and machine learning to really understand how is it looking today and why is it so popular today. So let's jump in and learn from him. Thank you so much for joining Secret Ops, Soumya. It's so great to have you here. Like I said, I was preparing for this chat, and we don't always get to talk to people that straddle the worlds between technology and data and also being a CEO and a founder of a business. And they require similar but also different skill sets. So do you mind diving into your journey of how you've gone from being technical, data-driven, CTO, now into being a CEO and a founder of Rudderstack?
Yeah, firstly, thanks, Ariana, for having me. I'm really excited about this conversation. Now, about that question, I don't think anything of was like planned per se. And I mean, as an engineer by training, did my undergrad in computer science, then came to close to Chicago to did my grad school and then finished my PhD. And then after that, went to a startup, spent 3 years there, and then started a company with two amazing co-founders. I was the CTO technical guy and sold the company and wanted to start another company. And it just happened that I was I thought I could have gone and found like a CEO, and I could have focused on the technical aspects, but I thought, why try to do that? I mean, I can like be the CEO myself and like be the founder and start the company. So it was not like a very thought out thing, but yeah.
You jumped in. Happened. That's very entrepreneurial of you. Let's just jump in and figure it out, right?
Exactly. And then and then I'm kind of thankful to like people backed you, right? I mean, my investors and so on. So like they gave me the opportunity. Like often people won't. They say like go and find like a business co-founder. But like, yeah. Well, that was not a problem. So here we are.
How is it for you as a very technical founder of a business? How do you think your view of building the business might be different from a more traditional business development or more traditional like CEO? Where do you think like you've had your unique lens of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to compare because I've never like worked with a CEO who is like very different. And even my previous co-founder, he was like the CEO, but he was also very technical. He had an engineering background and so on. So like it's kind of hard to compare. But I think in general, I do believe like the different cultures of companies, right? And like you either win by building amazing products, or you win by building like an amazing go-to-market motion, or you win by being an amazing storyteller, right? So different companies have like different strengths, and often the founders and CEO's strengths is what you're kind of betting on, right? And a lot of technology business, they have to bet on like product, right? And you're finally winning based on building the best product. So you have to take care of a lot of other things, but I think in the end, it has to be, you have to build the best product. And that's where I guess like your technical background hopefully helps.
Fits in. That makes sense. That really makes sense to me, because if you're coming in with a certain strength, you've got that lens of how you're viewing that. But then you have to also figure out, okay, how do all these pieces fit in? Like for example, you know, I'm an operator. This is what I do. This is what I breathe. I suck at marketing. Yeah. I'm really bad at it, but I know I have to learn it, right, to continue learning and doing. So how have you, I guess, what are some hacks that you've learned along the way to round out your skill set as a founder? And especially, again, like thinking about storytelling, that is not easy. Like yeah. you already have the technical piece, which is incredibly difficult to gain and to get experience in and to be able to do. Storytelling is this kind of like amorphous thing that you're trying to pin down. So what are some hacks that you've learned of figuring out that throughout the process of creating the company and developing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And it's not that I have figured it out, but like one thing I've learned is like, there are things you are good at, and then there are things you are really bad at, right? And you can try to improve on things you are bad at, but I've kind of given up. Like, I don't even think like it's what I'm like. A good example is like, I'm not good at like storytelling. That's one thing you probably need to improve, because like, finally, like you have to sell. Like you have to, even if you're not selling to customers, you have to sell to like prospects, you have to sell to like investors. So there is something you absolutely cannot avoid. But there are other parts, like marketing is a good example, right? I mean, there are founders who are super active on social media, and then they're like posting and in creative way, and they have a huge follower and so on. And then I kind of figured out that that's not my strength. That's not something I get excited about. So yeah, why even bother, right? And you need that as a company. But then the good thing is, like, once you have the resources, you can go and find the right people who can like excel on those things, right? So yeah, so I read this somewhere, but the core idea was like, generally the feedback is like, you have to go and learn a lot of things, which you probably have to, but something you're not excited about and you're not is your strength, a waste of your resources and time to like try to fix that, as opposed to you can just go and find someone who is good at that while you focus on what you can do better.
There's that energizing factor. Like, if it doesn't energize me, yeah, maybe I'll do it for like a couple months and then I'll just sort of drip off. Cause it's just, again, like for me, I don't really like social media as well. Like, I struggle with posting and doing that. And it just is not exciting to me. Whereas this stuff really energizes me, talking to people, learning from people, right? I could do this forever and ever and ever, and that would be different. So it's about that too. Okay, like, I got to learn this thing because I've got to learn it. But also, if it doesn't energize me, it's better to find somebody who's an expert in this thing and who really loves doing it to make what we're doing even better.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Rudderstack, because all we hear about right now is data and how to manage your data, how to leverage your data. And it's really hard to know where to begin. Even as an operator, it's like, all right, where do I begin in trying to figure out our data pipeline, what we should be caring about, our analytics, our dashboarding? So you all at Rudderstack have tried to niche down and to figure out very specific problems to solve for your customers. So can you bring that to life for our listeners? You know, what is Rudderstack doing and why start this company? What problems were you trying to solve?
Yeah. So at a very high level, we solve some of the data challenges around customer data, right? So any organization has a lot of data. Like, if you take, let's say, like a consumer company, let's say Amazon, right? They're like, they have customers, but then they have people who are like sellers and buyers. Buyers are customers, but like they have then supply chain, and they're like hundreds of moving parts in that organization, right? But then the most important part, if at all, is like the customers, right? And they want to know what their customers are doing on their website and in the app, what are the products they are looking at, and what are their interests, so that you can personalize the experience, right? So that's kind of one part of data that you need to like collect and analyze and like build applications on top and to make it better for your customers, right? So that's what we kind of focus on. There are like other parts of the data ecosystem also, right? I mean, like as I said, like the supplier data and other data, that financial data, or even like third-party data that we kind of don't focus on. Yeah. Now, why did I start this company? I kind of like, firstly, I've been in the data space for a pretty long time. I mean, my PhD was on data, and it was more of a theoretical problem around how do you secure data and how do you learn certain kind of algorithms on like secure data. But mostly academic, but at least it was in the broader data space. Like after my PhD, I went to a company called Data Domain, where again we looked at data from a different angle, though. Right, the problem was like, how do we improve backups? Then started another company with two other co-founders, where again the vision was to automate a lot of things marketing has to do with machine learning and so on. And I mean, if you think about like the life of a typical marketing person, like, there is like left brain and right brain work, right? Left brain work is around like being creative and coming up with like amazing campaigns and like designing creatives and messaging and so on. But then there is a lot of like and like data work that they have to do, like which customers should be like put on what campaigns, what is the next best action to take. And those are the things that like you could easily automate with machine learning. And this was like 2014-15 time frame. Now even the machine learning algorithms with like ChatGPT and so on have like improved quite a bit. So like in 10 years, a lot of that will be automated anyway. So anyway, that was the hypothesis of my previous company. Like we grew the company, we ended up selling it. And so again, kind of have been working in this space of customer data and data for quite some time. I felt like a natural opportunity. Like in my previous company, after selling the company, we're trying to set up a similar data stack, right? Collecting customer data, building use cases on top of the data, and felt like there is an opportunity to do something here. And here we are.
Here we are. Well, it's interesting to me too, because you've had your eye on data before any of us were even thinking about it, just like straight up. I think even going from the theoretical with your PhD into the reality of, you know, growing and selling your startup business before Rudderstack now, what has it been like to see the evolution of machine learning and artificial intelligence happen to us externally? It seems like it's so fast. To you, I'm sure you're much more knowledgeable of what that's been like. But how has it been going from, hey, we've got this like really small circle of experts who are investigating this, researching this, into now everybody's talking about it? Are you, is part of it like, all right, y'all finally caught up. Welcome to my life. Or is it exciting that people understand? Or how does it feel to be here at this point talking about machine learning and AI and how to use data better?
Yeah, that's a great question. Firstly, like, yeah, I wouldn't say like, I mean, by no means I was like the close to even the first set of people who worked with data, right? Funny thing is like in my PhD, like my advisor and part of my team also looked at like high performance data, right? So they were like running rocket simulations and like in these large supercomputing clusters. And this was like pre all the big data days, but this was like real, real big data. We are running like huge simulations and like generating petabytes of data, and they designed this entire enormous system to like store the data, process the data. But these are like more of like high, like big data at that time, right? And there was like a whole body of research that was done before that time frame, right? But I think one thing is right is like machine learning has become a lot more mainstream lately, right? Like if you look at, I mean, again, from the early days of computers, like people were talking about like, yeah, we'll have this amazing AI, which will do everything. And then you had like pockets of that, right? You had like Deep Blue defeating like Kasparov on chess, right? And this was like 90s. And this was, you won't even call it machine learning right now. It was just like rough, like tree search and finding like the best move, because like chess is a very constrained problem. So that was then. And then like in the, like maybe late 90s, there was this like character recognition. Like there was one use case of ML, which was put into production for doing like postal mails, right? I mean, you could now read it off and like print it. And there was like very, very one narrow use case. So these are like very pockets of use cases. And funny enough, like, I mean, my thesis was not on ML, but my roommate, he was like working in ML. And he said like, I wanted to get out of ML as soon as possible, because like there are hardly any job opportunities. Like nobody cares about ML, and the only people who cared about ML were like hedge funds, right? And then he went to a hedge fund, and so on. So it's kind of funny that 2007, 2008, like it was like the bottom of ML. Like nobody really cared about ML, and then like 2013, 14 is when like the initial days of deep learning, right? And this was the paper that Ilya published, and they kind of, like there is this standard problem of object recognition, right? I mean, you're given a bunch of objects and you have to find like what objects are there and so on. And there are like standard algorithms for there's traditional ML, like people use like support vector machines and all the other stuff to do that. And there are like the benchmarks were at some level, like 50% level. I don't exactly remember, but like there was at that level. And then like there was this paper from, I think, University of Toronto, where they were using deep learning for the first time. And that like moved the benchmark by like 30 points, right? From like 50%, they went to like 85%. And this was like a huge jump in ML in the 2013-14 timeframe. Like this was like the first use case of deep learning. And then like it was just unlocked like a whole set of applications after that. I mean, from that object recognition, then people went to like speech and like audio, and here we are. Like, it's the same trend that is going on, right? So ML, as like told, that like goes through this like curves, right? I mean, that like, it was exciting for some time, then like the complete disillusionment, like people kind of gave up, and then now it's like
the hype
again,
cycle.
But it's like the hype cycle again and again and again. It's not like one hype cycle. So we are again in that like peak of ML. Hopefully not a peak, right? I'm sure like we'll keep improving and so on. So yeah, it's kind of...
Well, there's this thing. So I was a couple of years ago, I was a creative technologist, and part of my job was flying around the world and teaching about emerging technology. And everyone at the time was obsessed with blockchain because Bitcoin was skyrocketing and crazy stuff. And part of the educational was we would go into this really deep dive about blockchain. And then we would talk about machine learning, and people were like, it wasn't even on their radar at all, really. Yeah. Yeah. And then it just flipped. Everything was about data maturity, you know, data knowledge. How do you have like data all-stars in your company, machine learning, and everybody's wanting to know how all of these pieces fit together, which I would say this year in particular, at least within the operational context, now all of a sudden all of these no-code or low-code tools have all of these AI integrations, machine learning integrations, and we're all playing catch-up. Because like, how do we even begin to start using this thing? How do you recommend people get over the paralysis of like, oh gosh, there's all of these new tools. I don't fully understand the technology, but I know it can help me. And there's that like, I don't know, that like mental block to get over. So since you've been in this world for so long, what tips would you give to people to start learning and integrating it into their work?
Yeah, and I'm not sure, I've been in the space, but like LLMs, but specifically ChatGPT is like such a huge step forward. Like, firstly, I was not in like involved. Like, there were these LLMs being built in like Google and so on. It was not like really accessible. They published a model called BERT, but it was again very like ML researchers mostly using it for very specific things, right? But like this like ChatGPT being released to the world is like such a huge step forward. I mean, it's like I'm also catching up. I'm trying to figure out like, how can we use LLMs in our like use cases and in our
that makes so, me feel so
I'm,
better.
Yeah, so I'm not like by any means qualified to give an answer to that. But I think like yeah, a lot of the workflows, even a lot of my workflow has like changed, right? I mean earlier like I had to before I mean like crafting an email was hard. Like I mean, and I'm not a native English speaker, so like I had to like worry about it. Now it's like, I mean, like ChatGPT takes care of that, right? So I mean, a lot of like, it is such a huge productivity boost, at least even for me, and like even finding information. So yeah, I don't know, like I mean, I think, but I do believe like a lot of like things will change over like the next 5 years, both in the ML community, like I'll give you an example, right? That recommendation systems, right? People have been building recommendation models for like the last 15, 20, maybe longer, right? 30 years. And the whole body of research that has been done in how to build recommendation systems, like Amazon's recommendation is built on like some like standard techniques, like collaborative filtering and so on. And I believe like that entire work might get replaced. Like people will start using LLMs to build those recommendation models. Like it's again, deeply technical work, but like, there will be change at that level, but there will also be change at like how people are writing content and so on. So, yeah.
It's true. I mean, I guess 2016 or 17, I went to a coding boot camp and I learned full stack web development. And now I'm talking to people because they're like, hey, you know, what is your experience after going to boot camp? And I'm like, your experience is going to be totally different because... Yeah. First of all the things that I would spend, you know, hours on Stack Overflow searching, you can now ask ChatGPT to spin you up a version. You know, it's like, it's so different in how quickly it's changed. I really don't know what it's going to look like in the next couple of years, because part of it has to do with adoption. Part of it also has to do with the creativity, right? Like you with Rudderstack, you're saying, hey, let's hone into customer data. Let's bring insights to our customers to help them see like what they're marketing to and what they're using. But that's a one very small use case. Like that is, there's so many things. Like I think the healthcare system, I'm really curious to see how machine learning is going to affect the healthcare system, because
yeah,
I feel like it has the potential to really grow leaps and bounds because it is kind of antiquated. At least, you know, but I think about like even, I mean, there's so many different lenses that you can think of. Insurance, like, is there a better way to do insurance and quoting and all of these pieces? Is there one area outside of your realm of data and technology that really gets you excited? That maybe you're learning too. Like, is there some piece that you're just like, oh, I cannot wait to see what happens with this?
I mean, healthcare is the big one. I do believe that. My parents are getting old and they have to like see doctor and so on. And I kind of make it a point like where if they like if for some problem like they're going and checking a doctor, I ask ChatGPT like, this is something. What do you think is happening? And again, this is a very small data point, right? But ChatGPT gives the exact same answer, if not better answer, right?
So interesting.
I think like the knowledge base is already there. I mean, for 80% of things, you don't have to go and see the doctor anymore. But I think the challenge is still, of course, like there are regulatory challenges. ChatGPT cannot give you a prescription and so on. And the second point is like around the human, like as a human, can I trust ChatGPT? Like when you talk to a doctor, there is that like psychological benefit. So I don't know how to overcome that, but otherwise like the knowledge is there. I mean, you can like get 80% of diagnosis from ChatGPT. So
that is, I never even thought of doing that, which seems so silly now because I'm going down Google still, but that makes so much sense. And if you think about it too, sometimes bedside manner isn't really there when you go to see a doctor. And at least with ChatGPT, you're not expecting good bedside manner and telling you something, but it's giving you information. I actually do find sometimes it serves you up information in a nicer way than if I were to, like, I don't know, I love my husband, but sometimes he'll serve it up sassy, you know? ChatGPT will give it to me without the side of sass, which always is a good thing. But I also think aggregating, you know, think about how many medical records we have, and trying to understand patterns in that data, that it's just so hard, even for doctors who are trained, you know, for decades, it's hard to see all those pieces that come together. Can we get assistance through machine learning, artificial intelligence to help us get some insights of things that we didn't even think about, right? Like I'm curious. I'm very curious about that.
I mean, this is the biggest thing I feel like, and particularly both in US and in the developing world, like India, like it is a problem. In US, it's so expensive to see a doctor. In a developing world, it's so hard to find a doctor. They're like one doctor per 1,000 people. So like in both these cases, like, I mean, thankfully we can afford, but like, I mean, there are people who cannot afford their doctor. And like they can probably ask like a ChatGPT and get a resolution, which like they will not have a resolution anyway. So
yeah, or even give you some inkling of like what this thing is or what the symptoms mean.
Even which doctor to see, right? Sometimes like you see one doctor and say, oh, you need to see that other person. Yes. I mean, ChatGPT, you could have saved one visit at least. Like ChatGPT would have saved you. So.
Oh, for sure. Well, this is interesting too. So you spend, would you say half and half of your time in the States, in the US versus India?
Maybe? I'd say like 60-40. Yeah, like somewhere around that. Yeah.
So what use cases are you seeing outside of the US that would be interesting? Like how are you seeing data being used in different ways within India that maybe we're not seeing in the US?
Yeah, that's a good question. I should probably think about this answer, but I think in some sense, India is very much like US, right? It's a democracy, like English is the primary language of communication. And a lot of our curriculum is very similar to how like people study in the US, because maybe it's kind of shaped on that. In fact, like a lot of the top engineering colleges were like built on the US system of education. So like a lot of things are similar, but at the same time, there are differences, right? Of course, like it's a much poorer country and access to these things, right? Access to a doctor, which like is kind of given in the US, assuming you can pay. Like in India, getting access to a doctor is hard. Like even if you're like well off, you have to go and like wait for hours to like see a doctor and so on. So like there are these kind of problems. Infrastructure has gotten much better, like from where we grew up. Like language, India has like 30 languages, right? And I'm talking about like different languages, like 22 official languages, and they're like dialects and so 22 like very, very different languages. Like it's kind of like as different as like Italian and French and German, like that kind of different languages. Although now that everyone I don't say everyone, but a lot of people speak English as like everybody kind of studies English and so on. So like, so there is that unifying language as well. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like what language is something I think like something like a ML can play a huge role, because like translation and that language barrier will go away, right? With this. Other than that, data, I guess like one thing India has done well is like we didn't have to like we almost jumped some steps. Like one good example is like payment infrastructure, right? I mean, India never built out like a credit card infrastructure like US, but then because it is like people couldn't, we didn't have the money to invest and so on. But like then everything is digital payment now. You could like literally pay with a phone, and that I've never seen that like anywhere else in the world. And I travel so much; like, it's so easy to make a payment in India, and I'm sure that is generating a huge amount of data, and you could like probably do interesting things with that data. But
I didn't even think about that. So is that when we're talking about like paying with things? Are we talking like, again, for my U.S. brand, are we talking like tap to pay? Are we talking like applications where you can transfer money easily? Yeah. Like, what does that look like?
So you go to a street vendor, like, and we don't have enough street vendors in the U.S., but like in New York, you have, right? People like you're buying something off the street, like somebody on like a pavement selling something, and you could literally like scan, like they will have a QR code. You scan and you pay, right? Like, it literally takes like 5 seconds. So that infrastructure, this entire payment infrastructure, and the money is immediately transferred to their bank account from your bank account. So there is no like credit card fees or anything. And this is like a zero cost payment, like managed by the government and so on. So like this payment infrastructure is like, I mean, better than anything I've seen anywhere, right?
So would you say that like India for the most part is pretty mobile first, like as far as because we sort of had this computer mid-step situation.
Exactly.
Which is now like when I can't tap to pay things, I'm I forget to bring a wallet. I'm like, I gotta go get money because I'm just not prepared anymore. COVID for sure expedited that transition. At least for myself, I don't think I would have tapped to paid as much. Yeah. But now, like inserting a card or swiping seems so old school and unnecessary. You know, like it's really interesting. So I can't imagine. When did you say, like, when did you start seeing tap to pay or the QR or the mobile first? When do you think that's really started to take a hold within India from what you've seen?
Main change was like, so there is this like conglomerate called Reliance, like in India. They were one of the giant industrial corporations, and they launched this thing called Jio, right? It was like a phone service, right? Just like Verizon here. And it was like, I would think, and don't quote me on this, but like I think it is like 1/10 to 1/50 the cost of like data in the US. So like
data is so expensive here; it's ridiculous.
Exactly, right, and it was already cheaper in India, and then like Jio launched this 5G service, which was like much, much cheaper than what was even available then, and that like really democratized access. Right, people who are living on like making $10 a day, they'll still have some kind of a smartphone, because like smartphones also became cheaper. So that was the big driver. Like it was in the 2015-16 time frame where this cheap data was released. Everyone got that. The other thing was like there was this thing called demonetization. So India, the government overnight like made certain currency notes illegal, and there are like a lot of there was a reason to do that. Like people like accumulated a lot of like illegal money in like raw currency, and then like the government wanted to end that, and so like all that currency note is like suddenly overnight illegal, so you cannot like cash it out. But anyway, but it did hurt the economy. But in any case, like that was the other reason. Then people felt that like carrying money, storing money in cash is not a good idea anyway. So multiple things, deep data, this one, like all kind of helped in this like digital. And now it is, of course, convenient. I don't have to carry cash. I mean, I just like pay with my phone.
Wow, that's it's interesting because like when I think about, you know, tapping to pay or things like that, there is this like painful moment. Usually it comes out of some chaos.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden you have to learn a new way of being and you're sort of forced out of your comfort zone immediately to have to figure out what to do next. It's rarely an elegant transition.
For sure.
It never is that way. But the funny part is I think we do expect that we'll slowly transition to this thing and it'll be really, no, like technology is hard. It's difficult. I also see that a lot when people are learning new technology. There's so much resistance because it should. I have like Apple devices and they make everything very seamless, almost magical. And as beautiful as that is, because it's helped with adoption, I've also think it's created unrealistic expectations. Like learning technology can be hard, and sometimes it will be, and it won't be pretty. Like even now, I'm a technical person, and I cannot get my parents' printer to work. Like I swear to God, I've tried everything, and I cannot get their printer to work. And that's just like part of, I guess, the muscle. At least when I started learning to be technical, you know, to embrace errors, that was like the first step, right? Like, okay, when you see an error, that's like a gift. If you don't see an error, you're screwed. So is there, having, you know, been technical for so long and having all these skill sets, for those who are not technical, is there, I guess, something that you can, a piece of advice that you can give them into ushering them into a more technical headspace?
Or does it even matter? I think like people will be interacting over voice, right? They're like, the whole way you'll interact. I mean, when I even like, look at my daughter, right? I mean, when I look at like how she uses technology and like, she is like, yes, I mean, now she has to use a computer because her school requires her to use a computer. But like her interaction with like a lot of things was like with Google Voice and so on. And this is like pre-LLM, pre-ChatGPT, right? I mean, like now, like in like next year, like, I mean, just interacting with software over voice would be like so much more natural. So I don't even know if it will be a problem. So
I didn't even think about that.
Like we accumulated some skills around how to set up a computer, which probably doesn't matter anymore. Right? I mean, like
my mind right now because I didn't even think about that, and I should have because my parents, that was their entry, right? Like Siri, my dad would be like, hey, the lady said it's going to be 83 degrees out. I'm like, who, what lady? What lady? You know, hey, Siri told me. And it's funny because I learned, I remember my parents said, you know, you have to go learn typing. You have to learn how to type. Yeah. That was like, I went to summer school to learn how to type on a computer and like how to do it quickly. And that really did serve me. But you're totally right. Like now, do you get voice messages from people like on chat? Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, there's a voice there. Like, it's so disconcerting, but you're right. It's like mobile, right? Mobile first, audio first, right? Like that's, they're just skipping over all the typing stuff that you and I had to navigate for so long.
In fact, like, I do believe like that's how like even Apple gets disrupted, right? I think like your phone itself, like that, they have built that experience, which was amazing. And they're the first to do that. Like from BlackBerry to Apple was a huge jump, but the next phone would not even have like a touchscreen. It'd probably just have like a, I don't know.
Oh, that's so true though. No, that's so true. Like the watch now, like the gestures, right? Like now people who have had accessibility issues, right? They've been able to do these sort of motions. But for us that don't have that awareness, like my husband all of a sudden is like tapping with two fingers. I'm like, what are you doing? And that's just where we're going, where it's going to be, you know, embedded in how we work and how we live. And we're not going to be stuck to these screens. I'm curious how posture might change with that too, because we've all got these like, you know, it's just these domino effects. Wow. So 7 years old and it's mostly voice, and voice to text has gotten better too. I think that's also a big change as well. Like meeting notes. I used to take meeting notes and that would be just soul sucking.
Yeah.
Because you would miss something, of course, and you try your best. But when I tried to do voice to text, I would say even 4 years ago, it would still sucked. Like I had to go through and like transcribe it myself and correct transcriptions. And now it's pretty seamless. Like, of course, it's still learning. And I'm sure with different dialects and different accents, there's a lot to still learn. But that's got to be part of the adoption too. Whoa.
I don't know if you saw that, like the language model, the models that Google launched yesterday, like Gemini.
No.
Which is like multimodal. Like, yeah, look at the some of the videos, right? And like they are doing like voice and image and text all together. And like you could like literally point a camera and then you're drawing something and then like, and then you're interacting with that, like the experience was around like Pictionary, and then like you're interacting with this computer in like all these three models, right? Because you're talking, because you're giving hints, and then you're drawing, and then you're also writing, and then like it's just amazing. So I think,
oh my God, I have to check that out. I can't believe I missed it. That's incredible. Well, and this also comes to like, so my husband and I like to play video games, and I'm late to the video game party. I didn't grow up doing video games, and the first time we ever used VR, I was like, here's the equalizer. So you, for over a decade, have been on a gaming console. You know, you have, you're so good at being able to use the device. But I, you know, went to dance for 10 years when I was younger. I can use my body. You know, I can be able to manipulate and have better awareness of my body than you do with this like little device that you're using. But, and that's, I think, going to be really interesting. The skills that are going to be needed will shift very quickly. And we don't really know what that could be. But for someone, you know, who's maybe more aware of how they move, that could be more of an advantage. For someone who's more like into typing, that might not be an advantage. So things that are seen at as a negative today, and maybe a year or two from now, it won't matter. Oh my God, this is blowing my mind here. So before we wrap up and learn a little bit more about you as a person, I would love to, I guess, pick your brain on one thing. So for those listening who are operators, who are in business, you know, I've got people who are post their careers and just listening to keep up. What is something that we should keep an eye on within the data space in the next, let's say, year or even 6 months? What's the one thing that we should keep an eye on?
I think the beyond the ML and AI stuff, like we have been talking about, I think one big, I would say like a game changer that has happened in the data space is this evolution of cloud data warehouses. So like 10 years ago, it was really costly and painful to collect a lot of data, store a lot of data, process data. Like you had to set up like a Hadoop cluster, if you know what it is. And then like there are all other techs, which were, you had to build it. You needed to have a team of like data scientists and data engineers, data engineers to like even set that up. And today you could literally like swipe a credit card and get like a Snowflake or a Google or like an AWS data storage where you can like dump data and with a tool like us or other similar tools like that. And then you can like build dashboards, or you can like even ask text queries, like and so on. So like processing data has really become democratized. I think like that's one thing, I guess, like will change a lot of things as well.
And that's something I for operators too, because not every operator is coming from a technical background. You don't have to be hyper technical, like you said, to be able to use and leverage these tools now. And oftentimes the problems that we're facing as an operator is like, we've got so much data across the business. I'm supposed to make a metric dashboard for our OKRs. Okay, how do I hone all of this data? Whereas before, you have to get, like you said, get engineering teams involved or learn the skills yourself, or you know, hand roll a solution. Now you can plug and play, and that allows you to also remain flexible, especially if you're a starter, a smaller business or a startup. You know, what you're doing today in 6 months might change. So building out a custom solution is honestly a waste of money.
Yes.
Whereas if you can plug into these, the data warehousing that's now easier to plug into, you can experiment, you can iterate quickly. It's, like you said, democratizing and empowering, especially for the operators who are listening out there. I found it very empowering as well. And that doesn't even bring up dirty data. Like, oh my gosh, if part of that is cleaning some data, I'm, you know, then I'm in love with whatever tool it is.
Yeah. In fact, like there are like literally three parts of the pipeline. It was always like that, right? I mean, you had to collect data. And then you have to like store it somewhere and process it and so on. And then you have to query that data. And then like this entire ecosystem was traditionally like you'd buy a tool like Informatica or like run your own ETL pipelines. Then you use like a on-prem data warehouse like a Teradata, or you like set up a Hadoop cluster, and then like you connect a BI layer. This entire thing has become like so much easier now. you can connect, use a tool like RudderStack or Fivetran or any one of them to like collect that data. You can like literally get a data warehouse by swiping your credit card. And then the querying part, like people are now investing, building like NLP tools. Like you can literally ask a question in natural language, English, and then you'll get a report back. So like this entire thing is like become so much easier. Yes, absolutely. So
totally. I remember learning SQL and I'm like, oh, why? Like, you know, so if you've never like learned how to use a query into a database to get information, and you don't know how the data is structured, or there's not good documentation, you're just like blindly trying to find stuff. It is so difficult that, like you said, natural language processing, all of a sudden the bar just lowers immensely. And it goes from, I mean, honestly, that stuff used to take me like a day to even get somewhat through it, you know, and to an hour, you can start to get some like high level insights really quickly. So, man, I could ask you a billion questions, but we've now entered the rapid fire question to learn more about you as a human being. So I'm just going to shoot them your way and you answer them to the best of your ability.
Okay.
Ready?
Okay.
Okay. First one is, what is the favorite part of your day?
Morning.
Morning? Like
early morning. Yeah.
Are you an early riser?
Yes. I get up pretty early.
What book are you currently reading, or what audiobook are you listening to?
I'm not a avid reader. The one I'm reading right now is Hard Things About Hard Things. It's a book by Ben Horowitz about like startup culture. And
that sounds so good.
Yeah.
Hard Things About Hard Things. I'm going to check that out. Yeah. What is the best purchase you've made under $50?
My helmet.
That is super good. That's the first time I've heard that. That's brilliant. Protect that brain. What is your favorite quote, if you have one?
I don't remember who is this from, but it's about like startups, right? It goes like this, and like I might be slightly wrong, but like it's ballpark like this, right? Bad market, good team, market wins. Great market, bad team, market wins. And great market, great team, magic happens. So market always wins.
wins. Market wins. What is something that makes you little kid happy?
As an engineer, and I haven't done coding in a while, but like when you write some code, like hard or easy, it doesn't matter. Like you write something and you run it and you see the result. Like that is like like joy.
Even if it's 1 + 1 and it equals 2, you're like, yes, 2, it happened.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like that all that, like with, I mean, I haven't coded in some time, and then I was recently writing some code and I was using Copilot and so on. So like, I think like the joy of coding is going away. Like ChatGPT will take that over, like any many other things like writing, but yeah.
The boulder feels less heavy pushing it up the coding hill, for sure.
Yeah, and that means that like you feel less joy at the end of it also.
Like, it is true. That's actually a really good point. When you felt like, yeah. When you press something and a button worked, I remember feeling like a god. It's like, my button worked and it submitted the data. Yes. Yeah. If you were to go back in your career and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give them?
Don't try to make everyone happy. I think that's maybe the one thing. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes like you're often trying to like please people and they're not pleased anyway. So,
yeah. Man, that's so true. And a hard lesson to learn. Very hard lesson to learn.
And yeah, as a founder, right? I mean, just to add to that, as a founder, I have to make hard decisions. And like it was hard, right? I mean, I had to like let some people go and it was really hard. Like I almost like felt miserable. And like, I don't know how many people hate me after like I have been like a CEO of a company, but probably it doesn't matter, right? So all my life we are often trying hard to please people. It probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's I've learned that too, and I'm a recovering people pleaser. It's impossible. It's literally impossible. It's a fool's errand. It doesn't mean that we don't stop trying.
Yeah.
But I feel you on that. Last question is, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty grown up already, but I think when I grow older, what do I think I'm like a very inward person. And what that means is like, I don't actually this is kind of contradictory to what I said, but I don't need a lot of like external validation, like people saying great, or like I'm being like great things about me. Like, it doesn't matter. Finally, like I like when I'm dying, I just want to feel that I've done more than what I could have done, right? So like, this was my ability, and then I've done more than that, right? In whatever way, right? So I think, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. That's a beautiful thing to think about too. It's not about aspirational, but it's about the feeling that we have at the end of the road here, and what do we feel like we've done. This was such a treat. If people are listening and they're like, hey, I want to check out Rudderstag, I want to check out everything that you're doing, where can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, I have like a hard first name, so it's pretty easy to find me that way. If you Google me, you'll get to my LinkedIn profile, or like, it's my first name at my gmail.com or rudderstag.com. That's one way. The other is like, we have a website, rudderstag.com.
And we will link everything in the description if you want to follow along, if you want to test Rudderstag, it'll be all in the description for you. This has been so much fun. Thank you for bringing the world of data and machine learning and technology to life. I so appreciate your time here.
Thanks, Ariana, for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation. And yeah.
Great. And Secret Ops listeners, as always, thank you so much for listening or watching. Please remember to subscribe wherever you find your podcast, or check us out on YouTube if you're a visual learner like me. Otherwise, we will see you next time. Hey, listener. Do you want to be a top operator in business and in life? Well, we at Secret Ops are here to help you do just that. Check out our monthly Secret Ops newsletter with exclusive intel just for you. From bonus content to secret resources, we've given you the VIP access. To sign up, check out the link in the description. And as always, thanks for listening.